I'm a little embarrassed. Last time you were here, you had a young man with you that you identified as your manager, and I had a whole publicity packet about you that I hadn't read fully before you came in. I thought you were just an author, you know, like most of them, just a writer. Then I found out that you're a whole business.
Oh,
a nightclub act. What else do you do?
Sure, I'll tell you what, it's been... I don't know, this got out of hand. I don't know how all this happened. It's just one day I looked up and I had five full-time jobs. I had to get up this morning at 5:30 and do my day job, which is write my Sunday column. But it gets tiresome. I get tired. But I've cut down. I don't do quite as much as I used to. So that's
a nightclub act. Now, what do you do? What do you do in the clubs?
I do really just sort of comedy. I mean, my stuff is basically stories. I don't try to tell funny stories as much as I try to tell stories funny. But it's just commentary and various things that's going on. The material I've had for 1,000 years. I've done 3 comedy albums. And one of the albums, we were cutting it. They did television, the videotape of it. And I was in Knoxville, Tennessee, I think. And they're going to show that Nashville Network on that Country Music Network in a couple of weeks or something. So I got to meet somebody today about that. But the whole thing started simply by I was writing this column, and a Rotary Club asked me to speak. And once you speak to one Rotary Club, the word gets out on you. Then there are 8 zillion Rotary Clubs in this country, and I want you to speak and don't pay any money. So after doing about 100 Rotary Club speeches, this is driving me crazy. How can I get out of this? And somebody said, well, charge money. Sure enough, I started charging $100, and I never got another Rotary Club speech. But now I'm speaking to every kind of group that's ever been in the world. And but I've cut down. I really have. It was driving me nuts. And we did a lot of concerts. We'd go in a town and just sell tickets, and we packed them in. It's really more lucrative, in some ways, just to go speak to these conventions, the big companies. They got all the money on earth. They don't care. You know, they just pay you anything. But I think the good thing has been that so many... there are just not many humorous speakers, and once they realize that you ain't going to talk nothing serious about them, they love you. They've been there for 3 or 4 days talking about tax reform and so forth, and, you know, I come in, and so it's worked. It's been a very lucrative thing. It's amazing. I never had any idea I'd ever get in this business. But.
Yeah, I was talking to Art Buchwald a while back, and he had the same problem you had. Everybody was asking him to speak, and they wanted him to be funny, so he found a way out of it. He now charges $10,000 for each appearance.
Yeah, well, I charge a little more than that, and it's amazing. Yeah, you still get it. But what I found out was I spoke to the Texarkana, Texas Chamber of Commerce, and there's no way to get to Texarkana, Texas. So a big oil man out there flew his Lear into Atlanta, picked me up, flew me out there in his Lear, and we did the thing, and... we had a little reception afterwards, and I was going to fly me back. And this guy came up to me and said, I don't understand why he got you so cheap. And I'm thinking, hey, you know, they paid that. He paid me $12,000. Sent a Learjet to pick me up, bring me in. I said, what do you mean cheap? And he said, well, I said, you're the biggest crowd we've ever had. So we had 1,200 people in the play. We sold another 800 tickets on video screen over to Howard Johnson's. And said, last year, we had Paul Harvey going through 300 people. So what'd you pay him? Said 22. So it's a weird business, you know. It's just whatever the market will bear. But what happens is when you start charging more money, you get to go better places. You know, you get the big companies to have the, God, I've been to Hawaii, Bermuda. I've been to Bermuda twice this year to make speeches. And, so I don't do the, you know, tough goddamn places to get to. Although I spoke in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Monday night, I had a 10 o'clock appointment in Washington the next morning. This is this week. There was no way to get there from Myrtle Beach at 10 o'clock. So I drove to Florence, South Carolina, and caught Amtrak and rode all night and got into Washington about 6:45 the next morning. Then I rode the Metroliner from Washington up here yesterday, and that was the worst experience of my life. That thing... I never been bounced around so much in my life. And then the thing, what they call the thing on top that connects, it exploded. We sat in Baltimore 45 minutes, so I put another one of those on. God damn. But these tours will get you. They will.
Now, you're on an extensive tour now to promote your new book, right? Coast to coast, is it?
Yeah, I got to go to Chicago from here, and then I take 2 weeks off. Last year I did 5 straight weeks, and they almost put me in the hospital, so I get a couple of weeks off, and I go back out on the road again. I go start in Florida, and go out west, and back to the Midwest.
Well, in your book here, the collection of columns mm-hmm. that you wrote, of course, you go into some detail about your tour and the various cities you've been in. And what's your favorite of all the cities outside of Atlanta? Of course.
Yeah, I like New York. I really do. I don't think I could live here, but I come here a lot. But I'm never here for an extensive period of time. I think New York is really great for an outsider if you can come in about 2 days. It's like Vegas. I'm saying I love Vegas for about 2 days, and I get out of there. I don't know. I love San Francisco. San Diego, I think, is a great city. The weather is probably the most perfect place on earth is in San Diego. I like Denver. I don't like Chicago. I don't like Cleveland. I don't like Detroit. I don't particularly like Houston, Texas, especially there in the summer.
It just looks like Atlanta.
Yeah, well, it's the goddamn the traffic there. They have really we've done a little something about traffic, but Houston is just impossible to move around in that city. It's incredible. But, you know, it doesn't matter. No matter what city you're in, if you're sitting in a hotel room, it's not, you know, might as well be anywhere in the world.
Yeah. All and the Sheridans look alike.
Yeah, once you travel for as long as I have. But I've got a new deal. I got somebody travels with me, a young woman. And that do make it better. Do you mind? Did I smoke? Is that an ashtray?
That's an ashtray. Yeah. When are you going to give that up?
Well, I quit for 3 years. And I used to be a tennis player. I played very serious tennis. And I was losing to people I was better than they were in tournaments. But they'd get me in the third set, and I'd be out of wind. So I just quit. My wife, ex-wife was a marathon runner. And I had heart surgery, which I had a thing I was born with. It wasn't anything that I caused. I don't think I lived through. I've never been in a hospital in my life. Never been sick, and it was more preventative surgery than anything else. And when I woke up and realized I had lived, I was convinced I was going to die. I woke up and realized I'd lived. The first thing I wanted was a big glass of whiskey and a cigarette. And I started back. I gave up cigarettes and golf twice in my life, and came back to both of them. I gave it hurt my shoulder to the point I could no longer brush my teeth, my right arm, so I had to quit playing tennis. But I want to quit. Believe me, I want to quit. I said I'd quit my 40th birthday, and that's been a year and 3 days ago, and I still haven't quit, but I'm still going to give it up.
Well,
I'm going to one of those, that manager's wife, with an acupuncture thing. They stick pins in your ears, and what they do, they give you this pill that just knocks you on your ass for 3 days. So you wake up, you're already 3 days ahead, you quit for 3 days, and then they give you acupuncture, and it's supposed to work, but it's so hard to sit that typewriter. You know, and not have a cigarette. I mean, it's just, God damn, it's just so...
Well, one of my colleagues here on this floor had a heart problem, had an operation, tried to give up smoking. He found it impossible. He finally went away to a place in California. It was like a hospital for smokers.
Yeah.
People who were so heavily addicted, mm-hmm. and that was the only way he broke it.
Well, you know, they are now saying that nicotine addiction, it may be the most powerful addiction of them all, and they're treating it now as an illness rather. My doctor gave me some of those nicotine pills that you can chew those now while you're weaning yourself. But that made me sick. I mean, it made me deathly ill, and that didn't work for me. So I quit one 3 years. I just put one out, and I did not smoke one for 3 years. It wasn't that bad. First couple of days, but I got insomnia. I had so much energy all of a sudden that I couldn't go to sleep. I had insomnia for 5 years. Start smoking again, I'm sleep good. I don't know.
Well, let's talk about your book, When My Love Returns from the Ladies' Room, Will I Be Too Old to Care? What is the significance of that title?
Well, for some years I've been married on a number of occasions, and I've been dating women professionally since I was about 19. And it occurred to me that women spend an awful... inordinate amount of time in a restroom. If you're at a place having dinner with a lady, excuse me, I go to the restroom, she could be gone for no telling how long. And this also happened to me. I was at a concert recently, an outdoor concert, and I went into the men's room, and there were women in the men's room, there were men. And the reason being that the line in the ladies' room was so long when they came in. And I said, it's not our fault that the line is. You know, we didn't cause it. Because if we go in your room, they'll put us in jail. But I think that the National Basketball Association should be in charge of women's restrooms. You got 24 seconds to get in there and out. But there's no telling what's going on in those restrooms. They could have a guy named Raul in there doing hairstyles, and they have Tupperware parties. I don't know what's going on in those things. But This actually was a country song I wrote one time entitled When My Lover Turns From Ladies' Room, I'll Be Too Old to Care. It didn't sell very well, so I just stuck it on the cover of the book.
Well, it's very catchy. How do you come up with all of these interesting titles?
I explained this in the introduction of this book. It's gotten to the point now that I think the title... I find a title, not a book, to fit it. I found that the title sell better than the book itself. But, you know, it's funny. I just started this today. This is my 10th book, and it just slowly began. And I wrote a book last year, My Daddy Was a Pistol, I'm a Son of a Gun, which really was a very story I wanted to tell about my father, who was an alcoholic and a war hero, and about my relationship to him. And it had a lot of humor in it, but it also was a sad book, and I didn't want a silly title. So I came up with the title, and I sent it to my editor here in New York, and he sent it out to all the booksellers, and they came back and said, no, we've got to have one of those bizarre titles. So I've given up now. My Daddy Was a Pistol, I'm a Son of a Gun came from an old Roger Miller song called Dang Me. There was a line there. We had to pay somebody, I think it was $500, to use that title. The one before that, Shoot Low Boys, They're Riding Shetland Ponies, is a line out of an old Jack Oakey Western. And I heard this thing years ago. A friend of mine said that one day, and I think we were deeply into beer at that point. And I always thought that was the funniest line I ever heard. So it wound up on the cover of my book. I did one of the heart surgery entitled They Tore Out My Heart and Stomped That Sucker Flat. That's an old country song called She Tore Out My Heart and Stomped That Sucker Flat. So Elvis is dead, and I don't feel so good myself. It's an old Mark Twain line. Mark Twain, you say, all great men are dying, and I don't feel so good myself. So I don't know what I'm going to do next, but the titles are becoming more difficult than the books themselves.
They're longer, too.
Absolutely.
Well, now, your new book, When My Love Returns from the Ladies Room, this is a collection of columns that you wrote for the Atlanta Constitution.
Right.
What's it like writing a column? You don't do it every day, do you?
4 days a week. I can best be described as saying that writing a daily newspaper column is a little like being married to a nymphomaniac. First 2 weeks is fun. After that, it gets to be true. You have about 10 great ideas when you become a columnist. They're gone in 3 weeks. And there you are, you against the world. It's Red Smith said writing columns is easy. You sit down at a typewriter and wait for the blood to pop out of your forehead. But it's great. It's a lot of fun when you got something to write. The problem is there are not four great ideas in a career, much less a week. That's what I do, and you just wind up writing about anything. As a columnist's prayer, God forgive me. God grant me my daily idea and forgive me for yesterday's. I had to get up this morning at 6 o'clock and write my Sunday column. And it's tough being up at 6 o'clock staring at that typewriter, looking back at you and all that blank word. And nobody can help you with this. You've got to do it yourself. You cannot call anybody. But you learn to do it. It's like anything else. You know that after a while it occurred to me that I would do it. I'll write about anything. But at some point I will get this column done. But I think of it this way. There is a number of columns I will do. At some point, I'll either quit, or I'll die, or get fired. So every time I get through one, I says one less of these things I got to do.
Why don't you subscribe to an idea service? They send you ideas.
Well, I explained that in an introduction to this book. There's an idea service out in Oregon. They charge me $39.98, send me ideas each week. I could have got one for $75 a week, give me better ideas, but I'm so like network television, we go for this same idea service. The thing that I try to do is to write off the news, for one thing. I mean, whatever's happening in the news, I try to find some angle to it and write about it. Writing humor is a very difficult thing. I write occasionally a sad story or a story with some pathos in it, and it's very easy to do those. But when you're sitting there and you in the written word, you can't use a gesture, you can't change your voice, it's just cold right there. And you never know if it's that funny or not. Is this funny? I have friends that I call, listen to this line, is this any good? And they're honest with me. Now, that stinks. Don't put that in there. But it is hard.
Well, have you ever had sex with anybody famous?
I sit in there. I had the writer's block as I was answering those questions. But I guess the most famous person I ever had sex with was Kathy Sue Loudermilk, a girl back home. She was famous. She was still a sex symbol when I was growing up, but when she graduated from high school, they retired the sweater she used to wear. But that's about it. Once a rodeo bull rider woman in Tulsa, Oklahoma, her name was Melinda. I first met her at Six Flags Over Texas. She was one of the rides out there.
Well, let me ask you a couple of things about the columns themselves. For example, speaking Southern. Southerners learning not to speak Southern.
What has happened? This is an incredible thing that I read this story in a newspaper that there is a lady in Atlanta that teaches Southerners not to speak with a Southern accent. I did some research on this, and what happens is that we have more Yankees in Atlanta now than when Sherman came through. They all live in a place called Dunwoody, and they drive Volvos, but a lot of them have been transferred down to the regional offices of IBM, Xerox, and things like this. So they think that if you speak with a Southern accent, it's going to hurt you in business, and they're teaching these people not to do it. I don't believe that for a number of reasons. One is that I think one of the charms of our country, and any country, is the different dialects. I think that with television now, everybody's starting to sound the same. I enjoy dialects. I don't think there's anything wrong with it. I said this many times, that people in the North think we talk funny. God talks like we do. I'm convinced of that. But it's just like somebody the other day was talking about language. In the South, we say dog. In New York, they say dog. What's the difference? You know, who really cares? They both know what we're talking about. Also, I think I explained in this column that I spoke to a professor of language once who told me that the Southern use of the King's English is more closely related to the aristocratic way of speaking in England than any other language. We changed words in the South a little bit to give more meaning. Southern way of speaking is a language of nuance, a very functional language. We can take a word and change it, mean it, give it all together a different meaning. The word naked comes to mind, N-A-K-E-D, means you don't have any clothes on. Use it up north, we use it down south. Sometimes in the South, naked doesn't quite tell the story. We change that word and we say naked, which is spelled N-E-K-K-I-D. The difference in those words is profound. Naked means you ain't got no clothes on. Naked means you ain't got no clothes on and you up to something. Totally different thing.
When did you lose your Southern accent?
I still got one. You don't think I have one? I still think I got a pretty good Southern accent.
No,
yeah.
You sound normal to me.
Well, I still say some pretty Southern things. And, you know, it's funny because I had people come up to me at a performance and say, you really talk that way? Yes, I talk. I've been talking this way, the same way, for 40 years. But I once had two stepchildren in a previous life, and I noticed in Atlanta, I noticed that they did not speak with a Southern accent whatsoever. And they watched television all the time, and nobody has an accent on television. And it's strange. But the one thing that's interesting about it, I go around the country speaking, is that people from the North and other parts of the country relate a Southern accent to ignorance. As I've said many times, I don't know how stupid Southerners are, but there's nobody from the South ever paid to go inside a reptile farm in Florida. There wouldn't be any reptile farms that weren't people of the North.
Have you noticed something that I think is kind of interesting? You have impersonators like Rich Little and all of these people, and the reason you have impersonators is that certain people develop styles, accents, and manners of speaking. Mm. But all the new actors today, all these younger ones, their voices are not recognizable. They have no distinguished way of talking. Mm. Who are we going to have to imitate in the future?
That's exactly right. Rich Little will be out of business. This is very true. It's a shame that we all are sounding exactly the same anymore. I do great impressions, but I do impressions of people that nobody ever knows. You know, I do a great impression of my history teacher back in the 10th grade. But I'm like you, and that's why I'm, the Rich Littles of the world, impressionists, have been great. I still enjoy them so much, and he's made a career out of it. But he also does, you know.
Everybody he imitates is dead.
Sure. And there's nobody else. Who are you gonna do? I think another thing's happening here is that this happened to me. I went to journalism school at University of Georgia, and you had to take, at that time I didn't know if I wanted to be in radio or newspapers or television. So I realized early on I had to get me a radio voice. And, so my mother sent me to school, a little town in Georgia, and I go to the University of Georgia, and after the first year I had myself a radio voice. And once you think you have a radio voice, you're always on, you know, you're always on the air. And I went back home, and my mother said, how are you, son? How are things in Athens? I said, about 75 beautiful downtown degrees, Mom. And I was saying things like, pass the potatoes, if you will. But, I think communication and television and, there used to be a few, network, announcers or reporters that had distinctive styles. There were some Southerners that you could hear occasionally, you knew that they were Southerners, but I think what's happened in the media today, especially in television and radio, is that so many times when television really began, a lot of newspaper people became most of those guys, the older guys who started with the newspaper business first, and they didn't have the training or with changing the way they speak and speaking distinctly and clearly and like this. But I used to be a disc jockey. I loved it doing that radio work. 15 minutes past 7 o'clock, 75 degrees on the south side, 78 on the north side.
Yeah, that's very good.
I can do it.
Excellent. Doesn't pay very much.
No. Never made a dime, did it?
Usually they pay $75 a week outside of New York. Now, you have grouped, When My Love Returns from the Ladies' Room, your columns in various sections. For example, the mechanical age, computers and answering machines and hair dryers and things like that. Why are you so against computers?
Well, several reasons. Let me say that I am the last man, I believe, and maybe you're an exception. I was sitting at a desk out there and had a manual typewriter, but I'm the last newspaper man, I believe, that refuses to go to the computer. Today, newspaper people sit, you go in the office, newspaper office today, you want to take out a loan. I enjoyed this business back when there were wire machines and there was noise and there were typewriters. You could spit on the floor and things like that. The computer to me has no soul. I have a 1959 Royal typewriter. I've written 10 books and countless columns on it. This thing responds to me. It makes a loud clicking sound. Plus, when I get through, worries me? I write an entire book on one of these computers. There's a lightning bolt somehow, and all my book is lost. I don't understand that stuff. Another thing the computer has done in this country, however, before the computer, when you messed up, you had to think quickly and come up with a great excuse. Today, no matter what goes wrong, people always say the computer went down. So, you know, my room is not available, sir, because the computer's down. I can't serve you breakfast. The computer's down. You know, that's ridiculous. In the old days, when you got caught, you had to come up with something clever to say, which is off the subject. But one of the things I think best about Ronald Reagan is that when he, in the Iran-Contra thing, Ronald Reagan simply said, "I forgot." Now, that's honest. The man is 2 years old in Arizona. Of course he forgot, you know. He's got his finger on the nuclear button. He's 77 years old. My Uncle Grover's 68, and his wife won't leave him alone in the room with the Cuisinart. So the computers, they baffle me. I don't understand them. I don't want to understand them. And I think that what happened to me more than anything else, I should have been born earlier. I should have been in the 30s and 40s, back when simpler times. I admit that I'm totally at loss of what's going on today. Grown men are wearing earrings. I'm glad my grandfather didn't live long enough to see that. Somebody asked me that I've been married 3 times. Do you have any children? I don't have any children. Because I'm sure if I had a child, I had a son, he would come home wearing an earring, and I'd have to drown him. The only thing I could do.
Now, do you write your column at the Atlanta Constitution?
No, I write it basically at home in my underwear. I found that I write better in my underwear than any other way, but I also travel all the time, and I have one of those little old Olivetti portables that is barely hanging on. They do not make manual typewriters anymore anywhere in the world. They do not exist. I don't know what I'm going to do. But I don't have any pattern in my writing. I try to write when I've got time or when I absolutely must. Emerson said that most men live their lives in quiet desperation. I don't think that's any more true of a newspaper columnist. I am desperate at all times. And so the last moment, I find I write better when I'm desperate. I write better when I'm on deadline.
But you have to phone the column in.
Yeah, I phone it to my secretary, Miss Wanda Fribish, and she can take it about as fast as I can talk. And a great thing yesterday is I was riding the Metroliner from Washington, New York. You can make telephone calls from the Metroliner. And I was sitting in the train dictating my column, and I felt like Bob Considine, the old days, something. You know, I'm old-fashioned, I suppose. All I wanted to do was I wanted to get up in the newspaper business, and I wanted to ride trains, and like the old days, and cover wars and things. And
I was talking to Russell Baker, and he has a column 3 times a week for the New York Times, and he loves the computer. What he does, he loves it. And what he does, he doesn't have to phone his column in. He uses what they call a modem, mm-hmm. Hooks it up to the telephone. And he says this way he doesn't have to dictate it. He just feeds it right to the New York Times. He can live in Virginia. And he says the nice thing about it is that the copy boys and the copy editors don't screw up the column.
All right.
Saying that the spelling's the way he wants it and the punctuation is the way he wants it.
Well, I've got a great site. I understand there's some benefits to it. There really are. But, again, it's just that the business has changed so much. It's my last link with the way the newspaper business that I had imagined it was as a child and the way it was when I first broke into the business. But my secretary can take it as fast as I can talk. She's so used to me now that she can do all the little things like that. Plus, if I started a computer, she'd be out of work. So, you know, I'm doing this for her, too.
I see you dedicated the book to her.
I did. Well, without Jerry Ferris, without her, I don't know where I would be. She's really great. She answers all the phone calls. So what happens is I can write all this obnoxious stuff, and they can't find me. I'm at home. So my poor secretary is the ones that the fundamentalists call. And it's amazing. I get on the fundamentalists good. If you mention God in a column, five people threaten to kill you the next day. It's the most amazing thing I've ever seen. But she has to handle all that stuff because they can't find me. And for that, she deserves. So I'm going to let her have this book at a tremendous discount price.
Well, oh, that's nice. She deserves it. Why are you so after the fundamentalist?
I hate narrow-mindedness more than anything else. You know, the bad thing about a born-again Christian is you got to deal with them again. I don't like the television preachers, I think. I don't understand why it isn't against the law to get on television and the people that send all this money in are old. They're poor. Many of them are ignorant. I get the letters that people send me from the evangelists writing letters to these people. And the message is the same. Either you send me some money, you're going to hell. And I just don't understand why we're on Ivan Boesky. Ivan Boesky is a piker compared to what the television ministry is bilking people out of these days. It's unbelievable. Jim and Tammy have been, I will say that the best time, I've been a columnist for 10 years. The best time I've ever been a columnist was during the Jim and Tammy thing, the Gary Hart thing. It was every day just, you know, there's something new here you can write about every day. They're gorgeous. Found out the other day, by the way, how Jim and Tammy first met. They both dated the same guy in high school.
They are a stunning couple, aren't they? I mean, to watch these people, you wonder how anybody can send them $5.
Absolutely. I'm not for adultery. I'm not trying to promote adultery here or anything like that. But I will say this. If you were married to Tammy Faye Baker, I mean, I think you'd just be okay to mess around a little bit. I mean, she's uglier than a bowling shoe. Imagine if she looks that bad with all that makeup on. What in the name of God she looks like when she takes that stuff off. My favorite line of the whole Jimmy Tammy thing, one man somebody came up with, so they finally took all the makeup off of Tammy Faye Baker. You know who they found? Jimmy Hoffa.
You're a little quizzical about the homosexual community, aren't you?
Yeah, my feeling about this is, I don't care. You can go make love to a telephone pole for all I care. I don't like the marches. I don't like the things like this. Another thing I don't like is the public involvement. We have a thing in Atlanta. We have a river that runs through Atlanta, the Chattahoochee River. It's a national park river. Every year they have a thing called the Hotline of Ralph Race. Every gay male on the face of God's earth comes, and then what they get in these rafts, and they float down the river, which is fine. No problem with that. But I did a column. There's a guy who didn't know about the Hotline of Ralph Race, took his wife and his mother and his two children on the Hotline of Ralph Race and got in the middle of about 600,000 gay men floating down the river. And he reported such seeing, very open, they were naked is what they were doing. They were just messing around and naked. And he called me about it and said he was shocked. And I wrote a column. I said, I just don't think you ought to float down the Chattahoochee River naked on a Sunday afternoon. I just really believe that. Now, what happens when you say anything that's a little critical of the gay community, what they do to retaliate, besides calling your secretary, is they give your name to about 10,000 gay publications, and Gay Magazine starts coming to your office, which is not the best thing to have happen to you. You have no idea how many gay publications there are in this world. I got them all I had to call each one of them and say, don't send the magazines again. But these people, they're like the women's movement. These people are mean. I mean, I promise you. And I said this about women's movement for years. I have no problem with a woman being able to do the same job as a man and be able to make the same amount of money. I just don't think women should be allowed to drive or play golf, either one of those two. But otherwise, I'm all right. But the women's movement needs a sense of humor really bad. If you so much as dare attempt to say that maybe the women's movement is not 100% correct, they'll come after your scalp. These people are serious and will throw things at you and call you all kind of bad names.
What kind of mail do you get?
Dave, my mail is 95% favorable, has been for the last 10 years. The 5% that is unfavorable is very, very unfavorable. We're going to kill you. We're going to come to the house and kill your dog. You're an idiot, you know, this kind of thing. But you expect that. I don't care if people get angry at the column. If they had no reaction, that's when I'm in trouble. And so what I want to do is elicit a reaction, whether it be anger or tear or laughter or whatever, get something out of them. And people call and say, we'll never read your column again. Yeah, you will, because you want to see what that lion sucker's got to say tomorrow.
Do you answer your mail?
Yeah, I do. I'm about 8 years behind right now. I get a lot of mail. I get some interesting mail. One thing I get is I get a lot of proposals from women. But I've never taken them up on. I'm like Groucho. I figure a woman that is so hard up for a date, she's got to write a newspaper columnist. I don't want to go out with her anyway. Remember Groucho said I don't be in no club that would take me. But I get some strange mail. I get the guy writes me and thinks he's Jesus. And he writes me all the time and gives me scoops. But there are some weird, strange people out there running loose.
Boy, you have a terrific memory. I think you have memorized all of your columns because you have all the one-liners and everything right there, right at the tip of your tongue. This is why you can go on the stage, right, and talk to people just right off the cuff. You don't have to...
I don't have any notes. No, I've got about, after doing this so many years, I've got about 4 or 5 hours of material, and I just find it fun to wing it. But you know, you ad-lib a lot while you're up there, and then this becomes a part of the routine. But if you have to write every day, create every day, you always got your ear out for good lines and you're trying to find out things that
you'd be terrific on a show like a Prairie Home Companion. I mean, you know, taking over from Garrison.
From Garrison, yeah. I don't need another job.
Have you ever been on that show?
No, I hadn't. I've done Carson a couple times and Larry King, Eliza and Larry King. Just last week, I thought I did Larry's television show and hung around for 2 hours and did the radio show. You're up.
That must have been fun. Did you take calls?
Hey, pardon?
Did you take calls from?
Oh yeah, took calls from everybody. I called. The interesting thing was, I followed the first time I was on. Well, not the first time, but the last time I'd been on King's show before Wednesday night. He did a show in Atlanta during the Forsyth County saga, and I followed a guy in a Ku Klux Klan outfit. I wondered on that show, when you are in the KKK, where do you go to buy one of those pointed hats that they wear? I mean, where do you get something like that? KKK Mart? I don't know. But I followed him last week, other night, he had the ambassador from Iran on there. And amazingly enough, the ambassador from Iran looked exactly like Ed Asner. And I've never seen those two people photographed together. It's just a thought here. But it's fun. I enjoy doing this kind of thing.
What's doing television like?
It's just as simple as anything else. I mean, you know, if you just don't, just talk, don't realize that you're on, you know, the million. But the worst thing about going, the worst thing about going on the Carson show was the first time I was scared to death, because if you fouled up on the Carson show, no matter what else you did in your life, win the Pulitzer Prize, whatever, you would always be known as so and so, comma, who screwed up on a Johnny Carson show. And you don't see Carson before you go out there. And what happens? They open that curtain for you, and there's a moment of panic when you walk up there, because I'd always looked at it from the television screen, where Johnny is always, you know, on the left and the band's on the right. But it's backwards when you come out there. And for a moment, a second there, I couldn't find Johnny and nearly panicked. It was very scary.
I'd be afraid I'd trip on a wire.
Or anything like that.
Or flat and the camera would get you.
Oh, your fly would be open. That's another thing that I worry. But I made sure, my mother told me that for years. Whenever you go on national television, first thing you do, make sure that your fly is zipped up.
Give it a quick swipe.
Quick one.
Well, I guess we can kind of wrap things up. Just one last question, Lewis Grizzard. Atlanta, Georgia, where you have lived all your life, I guess, or most of it.
Except for the 3 years I was held prisoner of war in Chicago. I was in
Chicago.
Yeah,
that's right. Sports editor there in Chicago. You must like Atlanta a lot and have no plans ever to leave, huh?
No, I don't. There's no reason me to leave Atlanta, because I can be anywhere in the world. Very quickly out of Atlanta. It is 16 hours from my front door to Moscow out of Atlanta. I left my house, and 16 hours later, I changed planes once. I was in Moscow. But Atlanta's a really nice city.
Isn't it true that any place you fly in this country, you have to stop in Atlanta?
I had to go through Atlanta. So, it's, you know, I can be anywhere, and it's a really nice city. When we finish it, it's going to be terrific. Atlanta right now looks like Sherman came back. This time he had jackhammers and bulldozers. We have torn the entire thing down and are starting over.
Well, Lewis Grizzard, it's your... Very funny, and it's a pleasure having you here.
Thank you.
The last time we chatted, it was a little more, it was funny too, but a little more serious, because we were talking about your father and the book about your father. But I know that listeners are going to love your book. The humor holds very nicely and translates well up here to the north.
Well, I appreciate that very much.
Thanks a million.
Thank you.